And this is the 9th of Noon Show on Highland Radio. Brendan Devaney is going to be with us in just a few moments to discuss tonight's DL debate. And we'll go to Brendan shortly. Let's look at one or two of your comments first. Caller says, I agree the railway in Donegal needs to come back. It would be very handy for people to come to Donegal from across the border and also from the south. It would be very good indeed. That's from Connor. Thank you, Connor. It would fit them better to upgrade all the roads in a mess rather than talking about trains, says a caller. Caller says, I'd like you to highlight this. My mum and dad live in Drumkeen. At 20 to 11, there were two bangs at the house. Eggs were thrown at the windows by young boys. The three boys were aged somewhere, the caller believes, between 10 and 12. Why were they out this late? And it's raining as well. I want parents to watch their children. Why were the boys out harassing elderly people? It's not the first time. My family are now staying with my elderly parents because they're scared. And if this is how people are behaving when they are children, how are they going to behave when they're older? If people know who this is, please have a talk with these youths, so says our caller. Now, a very interesting question indeed. Now, it is time for the DL debate, and delighted to say that Brendan Devaney is in studio with us. Brendan, good morning. I'll put your mic up, it might even be better.
Good morning, double take, that's all right.
Oh, indeed. Brendan, the DL debate tonight, some interesting discussions where we didn't have any National League for the senior men at the weekend, so nothing to talk about in the immediate term in that respect, but you're going to be assessing how the start of the season is going so far.
Yeah, and of course, Kieran Cunningham coming on, yes, Donald to do that. He's chief sports writer with the Star, he's from Glencombe Kill there, living in Dublin this long time, so... very interesting guy, you know, you'd hear him a lot there on the Nationals, covering many, many sports, and he always gives you a great insight. So just looking to, I suppose, pick his brain on where he sees football at the minute. And I suppose the reaction to Donegal and Jim from outside the county, what people are thinking, expecting of Donegal this year. So it'll be interesting to get his views.
Defeat to Derry for the Hurlers at the weekend in Division 2B, a discussion on that as well.
Yeah, you know what? Derry are the team to beat in 2B. They come down from 2A. Donald, good side. And Donegal missing a raft of players. Big turnover of players. Maybe seven from the team that started the Nicky Rackard final last year. So, you know, Mickey, I think, is unearthing new players there. And at half-time, sides were level. Donegal maybe could have got a goal. Derry did miss a lot in the first half. And second half, they completely pulled away. And then there was this period then where Donegal had a mini fight back. So... listen, all in all, I think Mickey's happy enough with the performance in terms of players missing and players to come back. So there's a 2 week break now, and I think he'll assess and take it from there. So Niall Cleary, ex Donegal player, Setanta player, I was at their dinner dance Saturday night. I don't know, Richie Power was there. I'm sure you remember Richie from your Waterford days.
Oh,
and
a couple of
tough days, I'd say. That Kilkenny side, yeah. So Richie was up a special guest, so I did a bit of Q&A with him. And interesting character. We had a brilliant night up in the Villa Rosa. You probably still hear it in the voice. Mm-hmm. And so Richie gave me an interview. It's not played this week. It's going to be played the following week. And we all know he was on Lochregale there. You know, he had his trials with gambling addiction and that. So.
Yeah.
Very interesting chap. Him and his partner Maria was up. My mum came along with me as well. So we had a great night in the Villa Rose. Well done to Setanta, of course. Ulster champions this year. Phenomenal season for them.
The ladies, it's been something of an up and down couple of months for the Donegal ladies. You'll be having a chat with John McNulty. He'll be assessing how the squad's coming together after the opening rounds. And I'm sure, again, he's looking to the future as well as the Hurlers are.
Yeah, John, listen, very experienced coach, you know, took up the reins there. Maxie Curran, synonymous with ladies. And with an era, particularly there in the last, I suppose, 6-7 years where Donegal were constantly knocking on the door, and there had to be this changeover. And I suppose John's come on now fresh. You know, he's had to unearth some new talent. Donegal are down a division. So just his assessment of where he sees the ladies' game now would be interesting. It's probably taken something like, you know, John to come in with that change in the guard almost from these, you know, unbelievably talented ladies' squad we have. So he's gone back to the youth, and just be interesting to see after the opening few rounds what he makes of the job and the situation, and of course the job to come for the rest of the season.
Mm-hmm. So the programme, it's just after the 7 o'clock news, DL debate in association with Sarah's Kitchen. Anything else?
Don't, that is about it, sir. Yeah. I am.
Going, as the man said, isn't it enough?
Is there enough there? Listen, we'll always throw on. You never know. Yeah. See, as the day goes on, then something can pop up.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're thinking, I'm afraid to say such an impression because maybe they haven't confirmed yet or whatever. So, yeah, sometimes we'll have an odd interview in there separate from what we discuss on a Monday. But by and large, there should be plenty in that to get my teeth stuck into, you know.
Well, I always say that the DL debate is the GAA programme for people who don't necessarily know too much about GAA, because it's always really engaging and entertaining conversation. Yeah. Very often sports analysis can be done to such a forensic extent that if you don't know the rules of the game and don't know everybody involved forensically, then it's all going to go over your head. The DL debate is absolutely not that show.
And do you know what? Interesting you say that. And I just, as we're talking there, Parry Calfrey was on the last show, and just like that, sometimes when you've you're doing pundits or Zoom and that, you know, there's a certain amount of engagement, whereas I'm sitting talking to you now. So myself and Park did a charity game where we did the commentary on it out through the tannoy down in O'Donnell Park. We had a great laugh, and I says to him, would you come into the studio? Because obviously he knows his football inside, or his GA inside out. So I said, come in and be like a co-host. Yeah. So we had a great crack there last week, and it was well gotten. Park will be coming on the show a lot more as the season goes on. So that's that dynamic you're talking about. We like to, you know, you want to cover the sport and have a bit of crack while you're doing it. I think that's what people like.
Yeah. And it's certainly always worth a listen. Brendan, tonight, just after the 7 o'clock news, the DL debate on Highland Radio with Brendan Devaney.
Thanks, Dylan.
It's the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Now, I was on my morning walk before breakfast, before coming up here to work this morning, and noticed a number of very large posters have appeared in Letterkenny saying that there is to be a public meeting on the 4th of March. I believe Padraig Tobin, the leader of ANTHU, coming up to join Mary T. Sweeney to have a public meeting to discuss a number of issues. So I'd like to say that Padraig Tobin, ANTHU leader, TD and Meath, joins us on Zoom. Padraig, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me.
You're absolutely welcome. You come to Donegal a fair bit, Padraig, and I'm sure you have some hopes for the elections in June.
Yeah, Donegal is a very important county for ANTHU. I would say Donegal would probably be politically the most aligned to where we stand, what we stand for in ANTHU. So obviously we're a party that has 5 years behind us now. We have a good organisation built up across the country, good representatives like Mary T. Sweeney, who are very active on the ground, you know, representing people on real issues such as the hospital campaign there in Letterkenny. And, you know, we are going to be selecting other candidates in the Donegal area very shortly for the local elections. And I think we have a good chance of taking seats. And I think, you know, the experience of Donegal is that it rapidly needs proper representation, because on all of the main issues in terms of investment, in terms of, you know, transportation links, in terms of healthcare, education, all of these issues, Donegal is not getting what it deserves, and that has to change.
The specific reason you've joined us this morning is to speak about the ambulance service, because you've been looking into a number of figures and through parliamentary questions and so on, and you've learned that the number of people who had died by the time an ambulance got to their home has increased by 70% in the last 8 years, according to figures, for 1,108 call-outs last year attended by the National Ambulance Service. The person was deceased by the time of arrival, and that was 100 more than the figure in 2022. That's a worry.
Yeah, these are incredible figures. So what ANTHU has been doing over the last while is we've been highlighting significant elements of the health service, where they're at and what solutions need to be put in place. Last week, we brought to the attention the pressure that's under GP services across the country, where people can't get, you know, access to GP lists, or even if they're on a list, it takes for ages for them to get an appointment. So this week, we have brought new information which shows that there has been a significant increase in the number of deaths that are happening now on an annual basis before even an ambulance reaches the individual. So in 2016, when there were 657 deaths before the ambulance arrived. And last year, it was 1,108. So that's an increase in nearly 40% in those years, which is incredible. And what it means is that ambulances are finding it far harder to get to their patients. They're slower in getting to their patients. And as a result, they're not getting them in time, especially in terms of heart attack, stroke, and issues like respiratory arrest as well. The information that we're getting back is because hospitals are so stuffed, they're so much under pressure in terms of their A&Es, that when an ambulance goes to an A&E, there can be a significant delay in the delivery of that patient to the A&E, which ties up the ambulance for ages. So in one example, in one part of the country there a while ago, there was 11 ambulances stuck outside of an A&E for 5 hours because they couldn't get their patients delivered to that A&E. And that meant for 4 counties in that region, there was no ambulances available for that whole period of time. So anybody who had a stroke, anybody who had a heart attack or respiratory arrest, their chances of survival radically decreased. And we know that the A&Es are under such pressure, one, because there's not enough beds and staff in the hospital, but two, going back to those GPs, because of the lack of GPs, people are going to A&Es now that would normally have gone to GPs in the past. So that's an incredible situation as well. The other element is that the National Ambulance Services is not employing enough people. And, you know, I make this point all the time. If you own a sweet shop in Letterkenny and you want to employ a person, you have to make sure that your terms, conditions and pay are complete. If they are, you will get to employ people. And we know that about 447 doctors emigrated to Australia last year out of a cohort of about 750 who graduated, and they left in large part because pay, terms and conditions were better in Australia. So this government is not doing at all what needs to be done in terms of strengthening its service. And as a result, people are dying.
One of the things it is doing, and we've seen in Donegal recently, the launch of what they're calling the Pathfinder service. Now, the Pathfinder service is a specific ambulance that goes to the homes of people who may be a little older, people that have existing conditions that are known about. And it's a response whereby the person can be treated in their home. The idea being that you don't bring them to hospital, that you may know what the issue is and they can be treated at home. So the Pathfinder will go to the home, treat the person at the home, and they can stay there. Likewise, you have the rapid response vehicles that will go, the smaller cars that hopefully can get out there quicker than the full ambulance if a full paramedic service is not required. And there are a lot is being put into investing in those services with the idea of trying to minimise the number of people that need to be brought to hospital. All very, very noble and all very to be welcomed. But your belief is there still does need to be core investment in the ambulance service itself, that those initiatives are not going to be enough.
Yeah, so we welcome every single initiative that's taken to improve services. And, you know, these are positive. But the fact of the matter is, last year, in 76,970 occasions, it took more than an hour for an ambulance to be able to drop their patient off at the A&E. We even found out that in certain occasions, A&Es were running out of trolleys, so they had to keep the trolley that the patient was on, and then the ambulance had no trolley, and then it couldn't go out on the next run. So these are like small, you know, issues to resolve that would have a significant impact. But all of the paramedics in the world, you know, in terms of these pathfinders and these emergency ambulances, you know, they're not going to be able to really make a dent in these problems, increasing the speed of access, unless we have the A&E service functioning, unless we have the doctor service, unless we have the beds in the hospitals and the staff there. And I will say, you know, there has been a small improvement in figures in certain parts of the country last year. But my worry is now that we're going to go into another year now where it's going to be worse because the government put a cap on the employment of people within the health service. And if you ask me, honestly, I think that
there are some areas exempt from that cap, and hopefully issues around emergency departments and the paramedic and ambulance services will be included in those areas that are exempt from a recruitment cap.
Yeah, I would be pushing for that to be the case, for absolutely. And, you know, if we don't have that situation, we are putting lives at risk. Like, and I'll give an example. In my own town recently, a person had a stroke. That person lived about 5 minutes away from the hospital. She had no car, but it took an hour for the ambulance to actually get to her home. When the ambulance brought her to the hospital, she obviously had deteriorated significantly because, you know, time is really important in terms of dealing with stroke. In the shower, and she banged her head against the floor of the shower, creating serious damage, losing a lot of blood. She was then brought to Beaumont Hospital. In that situation, then there was two people with a similar name, and that woman was given the wrong blood type because of that situation, and she suffered. She nearly lost her life as a result of that. And there was three adverse incidents that had been in effect practically caused by the fact that the hospital system is so overrun. And the figures on this are startling. Like, you know, A&E put in a question there recently to the government. There were 500,000 adverse incidents in hospitals between 2018 and 2023. 3,500 people died as a result of those adverse incidents. And the government has been spending about 1.5 billion euros on, you know, compensation to families for these adverse incidents. The whole system is incredibly hammered at the moment. The only way to solve that is for a government to have the political will to pay staff properly, to recruit to the relevant numbers. And so we actually get people in and out of hospital in a fast period of time. And not doing that actually has a cost, because that woman needed far more intensive treatment. She then ended up not being able to look after herself. She needed 24-hour care. And as a result, the state paid more money than they would have if that ambulance had just arrived in 15 or 20 minutes and got that person to the hospital in time. So there's a serious human cost, and there's a financial cost to the fact that the government won't resource hospitals and the ambulance services properly.
And it's also a chain. And the reality is, from what you're saying, every link in that chain needs to be strengthened, because if you strengthen the number of ambulances and paramedics that are on the road but don't improve things at A&E, instead of having five ambulances queuing outside, you'll have seven ambulances queuing outside. And if you don't improve the ambulance service but do improve A&E, likewise, you'll have better facilities in the emergency department, but you won't have the people brought there quickly enough to avail of them. So every link in that chain has got to be improved.
That's exactly it. Every element of the health service is interlinked. There used to be two elements of the health service that were still functioning up until recently. That was the A&E and also the GP services. But those now have started to get completely stuffed up as well. And the reason being is because the other elements of this have also been hurt. So an example of what you just said is so many older people are waiting for, you know, home care packages. Because they can't get the necessary home care packages, they can't leave hospitals. So on a given day, we would have about 500 to 600 people who are clinically discharged from the hospital, i.e. the doctor can not do any more for them. They should be at home or at another step-down facility. But because there isn't enough care packages and not enough step-down facilities, these people are stuck in those hospitals, which then means other people can't use those beds. And there's nearly about 400 or 500 people on trolleys waiting for those beds as a result. So, you know, this is not rocket science, and this is not an unsolvable problem. But I honestly believe that we have a political establishment in Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens who are tolerant of this problem. Reason being is because many of their voters have private healthcare insurance. They're not as dependent upon public spaces as others. And therefore, it doesn't seem to be a priority for these parties.
Father Thobeen, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. And we look forward to your visit in March, and we no doubt will be seeing you then. In the morning. Thank you very much indeed. That's how it's all been there. The leader of Enthu. It's the 9:00 noon show on Highland Radio. Radio, delighted to say, I am joined in studio by Cassie Lamb from Loretto Convent in Letterkenny and Rowan Buchanan from the Abbey Vocational School in Donegal Town. And they've both been elected as the Donegal Regional Officers for the Irish Second Level Students Union. Cassie, no stranger to this programme. You've been on with Greg several times speaking about young persons' issues. Great to have you in studio face to face.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure. And Rowan, you're very welcome indeed. We did get to meet the last time the Donegal Youth Council made a presentation to members of the MD in Letterkenny, and you're very welcome as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, pleasure to have you both. Cassie, want to go to you first, because you've been involved with ISSU now for quite some time, and you've been a spokesperson for the past couple of years.
Yeah.
How important is it that Donegal has a voice in that body that can carry the views of local students to a national body, and from that national body to government and the department?
It's so important for myself. Anyways, I've been involved with the ISSU for the past 3 years, since I was in first year. And I've worked with many organisations, many different young people from all areas, from local to even other counties and even nationally now, which has been a great opportunity for myself. What is so important for Donegal is to have a voice is because Donegal is the forgotten county, of course. TDs also need to hear young people's voices, like myself and Rowan's voice. And, you know, we need young people to be there to actually give the student support, saying you can always come to us if you have an opinion or something's happening in your school that no one's going to speak up about. And we're here to support them and to bring their issue right to the big boys at the Dáil and Éireann.
Yeah. Rowan, you've been involved in the Donegal Youth Council, so you're no strangers to the meetings, you're no stranger to dealing with the politicians, but also because you're in the Youth Council, you're liaising with students and you're liaising with young people on a day-to-day basis, so that's put you in a very good position to have a finger on the pulse of what's important.
Definitely. I think in most youth organisations, they rely quite heavily on students and especially student councils and elected representatives, as in the ISU representatives in each school or the Donegal Youth Council or the student councils. It's a big thing that we have such a variety of schools, going from the Gaeltachts to the ones in Letterkenny all the way down to Donegal Town. And there's such a variety of students now, and our schools are growing even more. So it's a really big issue to keep in contact with the schools, because that's where the issues lie, especially for the ISSU, obviously, because that's the student union.
Obviously, we do have TDs in Dublin, and you've met with them, I'm sure, yourselves, both in the UK Council context and yourself, Cassie. Always going to take the opportunities. Important that it's also a two-way communications, because it's one thing for you to go to ISSU and then from ISU then to government. What level of contact is there coming back? To what extent are you hearing back through ISU from the TDs, from the department, from the government, responding to you and giving you answers to the questions that you're asking?
Well, firstly, I'd always kind of nearly put my foot down. You know, rural students is such a topic that I'm very passionate about, whether it's from transportation to the mental health of our own students. Between the connection between young people and TDs is a little bit lacking recently. You would get in contact with them through the ISSU, through the Quishkenog and to the TDs, and nearly takes a while for them to get back to you and to give you a straight answer of how can we resolve some issues like the ideas of vaping or the mental health of students, and how can we actually support students in a better way. So it takes them a little bit longer nearly recently to get back to us, give us the straight answer of what we actually need.
Yeah. And the vaping one was interesting because you were actually ahead of the curve, Rowan, because Donegal Youth Council was doing a lot of work on it, and you were about to make a submission to the Health Minister asking him to take some actions. And he actually pretty much announced those actions before you'd even got a chance to put them to him. So, I mean, it really shows you did have your finger on the pulse on that one.
Well, we definitely had our finger on the pulse, but I do feel like the Health Minister, he answered in the sense of it is now illegal to purchase vape under the age of 18. But that is one of the many issues that is involved in young people being
addicted to vapes.
I know
there was issues with the flavours and that as well that haven't necessarily been addressed.
Exactly. The young people are crying out for those things, the advertisement, the flavouring, the fact that there's the same amount of nicotine as a packet of cigarettes in one vape, and yet the prices are so inconceivably different. A young person can afford to buy vapes, a young person can't, in the sense of cigarettes. They are being taxed and going up every year, and the Health Minister hasn't answered those. The government hasn't answered that, even though young people see vaping as such an issue. It has been highlighted multiple times through multiple surveys. Anytime you talk to young people, it is the first thing that is brought up, vaping. We all know it is an issue. We all know amongst ourselves. We've asked them to fix it in the sense of banning flavourings, taking away that excitement, but it hasn't happened.
Do you have any confidence that it will happen, given that the responses you've had so far? Or is this, and it can so often happen, and we've had this discussion before, Cassie, with yourself. I mean, those wheels of bureaucracy at national level can move so, so slowly. I mean, and the fact that they're moving at all sometimes can be a positive sign. And it would seem at least Stephen Donnelly has taken some action. Is he giving you the impression he will take more?
Well, personally, as well as through the organisations, we haven't actually heard that he would. We heard that he supported what we had done and that he was, you know, he saw these issues, but there hasn't actually been any communication for this action being taken. Now, in the EU and in other countries, there seems to be action, so hopefully that will then influence it coming into Ireland. We are quite an influenced country, and we are in the sense that if something happens in the UK or something happens in the EU, it filters through to us. I don't want us to have to wait for that to happen, though. I want us to take our own initiative and get there before before we have to get it from there.
Obviously, we're speaking about sort of wider issues, be they mental health, be they vaping, be they transport or whatever. But there are also issues coming up that are very much centred on school and the school experience. One of them, oral exams and overhauls needed there, Cassie.
For the oral exams for Leaving Certificate students, personally, myself, I'm very unhappy to see it during the Easter holidays. The Easter holidays is for the students to take a break, to actually prepare yourself. You need that time to rest, not just for yourself, for your parents, and just take a minute for yourself. But you can't do that now because you have your oral examinations and you will be studying constantly and constantly. And many students have said that they were very upset and they weren't very happy that they couldn't take that time, and they felt that they didn't go out there and do their best because they weren't prepared, they just weren't ready to do it. And you know, it's hard to come from going through, say, March, and then next thing you get a few days notice, remember you have to do your oral, when you're always putting your head into the writing of it, and you know there's 20 scribe pictures and only one of them will come up.
Yeah.
You're like, that's the thing. And for the past 2 years, it's only been the 10 scribe pictures. And now for the class of 2025, they'll have to do the whole 20. Rome will have to do the whole 20. I'll have to do the whole 20. Yeah. And only one of them will come up. And me to do that, I think that's already daunting. Like, I have a sister, she's doing her Leaving Cert, she only has to do the 10.
Yeah.
And that's already just a lot in general. And if you just learn one not as good as the others, if that one comes up, you might be really angry and upset over it.
Yeah.
Than compared to the 20.
But that's what you're going to be judged on. And you're going to be judged on, you know, the chance that you may know one a lot better than the other.
Yeah.
And the question is, are you being examined on your ability to speak Irish, or are you being examined on your ability to remember something you read about a topic that was in a book?
Exactly. And that's not really the way how we should be taught. Yeah. We need to be taught saying, this is vocab. You can't really be, like, there's students who can sit down and learn essays, just reading it over and over. I'm not like that. I'm a kinesthetic learner. I have to be writing. I need maps. I need something. Not every student's like that. There's very rare students who can sit down and just learn it.
Yeah.
And teachers and the Department of Education really need to take that into focus, saying there's different type of learning of students and we actually need to start supporting that in our education system.
Ron, the other issue is paper one in English, Irish and maths, and the first three. And I know when I was going through all this 43 years ago, I mean, I remember that I was really, I mean, and it was really worrying me because, I mean, you've got English, it's English, paper one, paper one, paper one. And you're sort of so caught up in it. There's paper one, paper two. And sometimes you can end up with doing maths, Irish, English, English, maths, Irish, you know, all three within 4 days, and it is a huge amount. And there may be, you want to see that looked at with regards to how can they be packaged in such a way that's putting less strain on students. Because the opening, it's like, it's sometimes you start something and you ease into it. With the Leaving Cert, the last thing you're doing is easing into it. You're diving into it head first.
I really don't understand why most of the students who do their Leaving Cert, their Leaving Certs are condensed into 2 weeks and they are doing 2 3-hour exams a day. How by the end, after 3 days, you are exhausted.
Yes.
Mentally, physically, there is no way that you are then going to continue for another week. And let's say if you have studied equally for all of those and your predicted grades are H1s, H2s, but you are mentally exhausted, there is no way that in a marathon you're meant to pace yourself. Out the gun, you are doing hours and hours back to back, in the first week to then continue on. It's absolutely mental. But in regards to paper one, this new system is talking about doing the paper one in fifth year, at the end of fifth year, which I really, as a fifth year student, right now, I am learning material. I have done a couple of essays for things like history, for Irish, for English, but I don't think I've done enough to have it be my Leaving Cert. My Leaving Cert is, at the moment, our only way in Ireland to get to college is your CAO points. And that currency, it's the CAO is a currency. It's how much can you get, and a race to the points. And for that to then be sort of relying on me having that, you know, skill and those enough papers to be graded for me to feel confident to do it at the end of fifth year. I don't think we have that. Fifth year is a lot about learning the material, and sixth year is about how can you process that into the papers? How can you answer the questions with the material you've learned?
There has been a lot of talk about continuous assessment, and it's coming. And I'm not quite sure if they still have a full focus on exactly how that's going to be implemented. But is there a way of saying, well, look, what we will do is we will do an element of paper one at fifth year that will take into account the fact that you're 50% of the way through your Leaving Cert course. But then along with some continuous assessment that will go through your fifth year and sixth year experience, so that by the time you get to the Leaving Cert, you'll have elements of it done through fifth year, elements of it done through the continuous assessment, and that will take some of the pressure off, because at the moment what's happening is that everything depends on what happens in a room over a series of three-hour exams between whatever it is, June 6th and June 18th. And it's all focused on that. And if you're not in the right place mentally, if you're not in the right place physically, if you go in there with a cold and that throws you off, or if you, as happened to me, I sat in an Irish exam and I could not remember the word for key. And all I could think of was clef. And I knew clef was French. I could not remember. And I remember sitting in my Irish exam for a good 10 minutes, completely mentally blocked on the fact that I couldn't remember the Irish word for key. Until I just moved on. And that can happen. And it happens to everybody, I think, at some stage. And if it happens during a Leaving Cert in an important exam and hampers your marks. So, you know, there's got to be some way of bringing in this long promised. And they were talking about continuous assessments when I was in school,
yep,
in the 70s and 80s. And they still haven't quite got that package. So maybe that, along with the end of fifth year, it could be part of it, but not just paper one at the end of fifth year as an exam and then paper two at the end of sixth year, that do it in a more nuanced way.
Exactly. I definitely agree with that. It takes some stress off of the Leaving Cert. And like you said, it means that then everything isn't relying on that.
Yeah.
But that whole, okay, and now you're sitting it. After TY, where you don't do much of the course, that it, you would have to bring in the Leaving Cert course into TY. You would have to be studying in TY. And for me personally, who's just done TY, I did a load of work experience. I got into Donegal Youth Council. I got into ISU. That was me realising where I wanted to go. Do I want to go into politics? Do I want to go into history or law? I was able to kind of broader look at other aspects that wasn't academic. What actually am I passionate about? To bring the academic side back into TY, I think, then you're not getting the TY. You're not getting...
And the whole point of TY too is personal development, and you're finding yourself as a person.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because, like, say as myself, I'm in third year right now, and I just did my mocks, and, you know, if you thinking right now, I'm dreaming of TY, that's what's keeping me motivated right now. And it's just nearly that if this assessment came in fifth year, and I had to do paper one in fifth year, that means it's not really going to be TY, is it? When I'll have to still study English and Irish and still be thinking, well, you have to keep working because you still have exams, where TY is where, as Rowan had said, to develop as a person, to develop your CV, to develop of what you want to do. Because how can you go in to do a paper one exam and not knowing what you actually want to do and what courses you want to do in college? This is the time where you experiment of different working place and where would you like to go and where would you like to see yourself in by 3 years' time?
And also in terms of choosing subjects.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, I would certainly say I made wrong decisions in terms of choosing subjects for Leaving Cert, because I had to choose them in the middle of third year, because there was no TY when I was going through. So we literally went, and it wasn't Junior Cert, was, you may have heard this in your history class, it was the Inter-Cert I did. But it literally, we went Inter-Cert, and we had this first year, second year, third year, Inter-Cert, then fifth year, sixth year. We didn't do a fourth year, this just didn't exist. So it went first year, second year, third year, fifth year, sixth year. And there was nothing like TY. So you were making choices for the Leaving Cert when you were
14, 15.
I mean, and I was. I turned 15 the week before I did my Inter-Cert. And I turned 17 the week before I did my Leaving Cert. And looking back, I'm thinking, you know, I was practically still 16 when I did my leaving, you know, and that was too young for the leaving. And yeah, there was pressures there. And certainly, yeah, TY, I can really see the benefits, because, I mean, obviously I saw my own kids go through TY and I saw my younger brothers go through TY, and looking at them and going, I wish I'd had that. I really wish I'd had that.
Yeah.
But it is important. In terms of ISU and, you know, your issue presumably will listen to what you have to say, listen to your colleagues in the other counties, and then ISSEA will come up with an agreed policy. So what then happens? So you come to ISSEA with your issues, yes, be it regarding paper one, paper two, be it regarding the orals or whatever. You bring them to ISSEA. What sort of conduit does ISSEA have? Does ISSEA have meetings with Norma Foley, or is it meetings with her department? And is Norma Foley and her department taking ISSEA seriously?
Well, for the ISSU, we have a proper seat at the Department of Education. There can't be any conversation about us without us. We have to be there, because realistically, the Department of Education, it's not going to harm them too much. It's harming us, the students. It's our education, and it's our right to know what's actually happening up in the Department of Education. So the ISSU, if there's any big decisions like the Leaving Cert reform, like the Junior Cert reform, the ISSU, most likely Uachtaráin, Shari, would go up into the Department of Education, and our Officer for Education would also go up too. And they're representing the whole Republic of the students. They're representing all of us. The ROBs, like myself and Rowan, we would give our input and say we do agree with it. So you have our permission as the Donegal students to put it forth. And they would sit down with Norma Foley and they would say, here, we agree, we don't agree with this. You know, ISSU will always rely on the students' opinions, because that's who we are representing. They're not really representing themselves. It's all the students.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Cathy Lamb, Rowan Buchanan, absolute honour and pleasure to speak to you both. And it's great to know that when it comes to the interests of our second level students, they are being very well articulated indeed. Cathy, Rowan, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Just before we go to our next caller, I want to very quickly bring to you the response we got from the HSE with regards to a question. A question was raised last week on the show with regards to dental treatment for school students, and a caller told Greg that they were awaiting an appointment and was advised that the school dental service is only seeing children requiring fillings or extractions, or children in sixth class. And the parents said, expecting a child to wait almost 4 years to be seen is ridiculous. It's only going to worsen the problem in the long term. With the money being spent in other areas, surely our government can come up with a better plan. We have received a response from the HSE Dental Services. Due to the impact of COVID-19, initial routine dental services were suspended and access to services nationally were restricted to emergency treatment for a period of time. Nationally, policy is to provide dental screening and dental care to three primary target groups, second, fourth and sixth classes. Due to staff retirements and the shortage of dentists available nationally, the dental service has been operating with a significant shortfall of whole-time dentists, and the service is currently operating at 50% staffing levels. This has resulted in an inevitable delay in progress through target classes, resulting in a significant unmet treatment need, and therefore an increase in children presenting as emergencies. Anecdotally, we know that post-COVID, tooth decay in children has reached significant levels, particularly in vulnerable groups, and we're providing dental screening and treatments to sixth class. The dental service is also providing adult emergency dental care. Significant support has been provided to the service by senior management for recruitment campaigns, and it's hoped that they will be able to recruit more into the future. So that's the response there from the HSC. Now, I want to go to line one, because we're joined by Angela, who is living in Scotland and has a number of things she wants to get off her chest. Angela, what are the issues that you wish to discuss with us?
Hi there. I was listening to the radio yesterday, to the news, to Highland Radio, and it was all about the immigration situation in Ireland. And I felt quite personal about it. For me, personally, I thought it was really not nice for the people that are coming from other countries. Probably for me, there's three strands to the debate. I'm first-generation Scottish.
Yeah.
My parents came here almost 70 years ago. They were told to go back to their own country. They didn't. They stayed and they worked hard. They were respected within the community. They brought their own traditions, their values, and they were well respected. And I think they added to the community, which I think other people do, because the diversity is really important. My daughter has lived in Australia for 12 and a half years. My son's going there on Thursday. They're going to make a better life for themselves. And I don't see why it's any different for the people coming to Ireland. And thirdly, I'm the manager of a day service for adults with learning disabilities and real complex health needs. And it's really hard to get workers, but the people applying for the jobs are coming from other countries. Mm-hmm. They're hard working. and they stick. They want to learn. They're really adaptable. They're really happy to be here.
Yeah.
And I feel it's a better workforce with a lot of diversity.
Yeah. Just to put into context what was actually on, if you're referring to the news bulletins yesterday afternoon, there was a survey done by one of the Irish Times and Ipsos did an opinion poll, and it was published at the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically found that the majority of people, over 60% of people, did believe that immigration had been good for Ireland. And over 60% of people believed immigration had been positive. However, a number of people did have concerns, particularly in terms of the availability of services and also in terms of housing. And there were some other questions as well in terms of the location, particularly of refugees in local areas, and a number of people didn't believe that was being handled well. So that's just the context of what you've been hearing.
Yes.
But I think the bottom line was over 60% did believe that immigration had been good for the country. You believe that's not sending enough of a signal as is necessary that immigrants are welcomed and valued?
Well, the fact they're having marches, like people marching the street basically saying they don't want them there in small towns and communities, I think gives it a really, really bad impression. Mm. And for the young people that live in these towns, what does it say to them? Do you know? And I think it's a government issue. The government should be dealing with it better than what they're doing, instead of blaming all these people.
Well,
that's
I mean,
just my personal opinion, but
yeah, it's. I mean, the question, I suppose, the government will argue, look, it's doing what it can. The government is trying to deal with the situation where there are refugees who have a right to be here under international law coming in from Ukraine. You have people seeking international protection. There are issues with housing. There are issues with capacity. And one of the problems always appears that when you have issues with housing and capacity, people look and they ask questions along the lines of, well, how come he gets it and I don't? How come she gets it and I don't? And that's always going to be a dialogue. But that's one of those issues that's always going to be there.
Yeah, that is going to be there, but I think I could be handled a lot better than it is. And it's easier to put, it's very easy for the government to let all this happen. And if people fight amongst themselves, they take a back seat.
Yeah.
That's what I think anyway. Do you know, I think we could be doing a lot more.
So you would
and
like to see...
And it's a big right wing, isn't it?
Yeah. And
there could be more social housing, couldn't there? There could be a lot more social housing.
Yeah, and the government and the councils will say that's what they're trying to do, actually, is get more social housing built. They're on the back foot to a certain extent, but they're certainly trying. You want to see that sped up a bit more.
Without a doubt. Yeah. And it's not any different in Scotland as well.
Yeah.
The same problems are here.
Yeah. Angela...
And it's very easy to pick on the person that's just come in. No bother.
Yeah, Angela, listen, thank you so much for the call. It's a valid opinion, and it's an opinion we value, and thank you indeed for sharing with us this morning. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. That's Angela there speaking to us from Scotland. Very quick comment before we leave. Caller says, I was in Letterkenny a few weeks ago. I don't think having private health insurance makes a difference. There is only one doctor to see people. I have private health insurance and we were all treated the same. That's pursuant to our conversation with Padraig Tobin earlier. And I suppose the bottom line too is when it comes in particular to GP services, the fact is... those of us that don't have medical cards are paying for that GP service, so we are effectively to our GP. We are private patients, we are paying for a consultation and paying quite handsomely at times. And that's where we have to leave it at the 9 till noon show. Thank you very much indeed to our listeners. Thanks for your contributions, thanks for your texts and your messages. Thanks to all who contributed. Most importantly, thanks to you for listening. Thanks to Shannon for her help, Donna Marie as well. Thank you. A special thanks to Caroline, who produced and, as always, held my hand through the show. And without it, it wouldn't have happened. Thank you all. We're back again tomorrow. Coming up next, it's Around the Northwest with John Breslin. But for myself, Donal Kavanagh, have a very good day.